So last night was kind of fun for those who made it out to the Hanukkah celebration. We had some good time, had some fun with some of those songs. My cheeks hurt for I don't know how long because it just made me laugh so much on the play on some of those songs. But anyhow, as I said last night, that's part of what we forget about, you know, the celebration. The old Jewish saying about, you know, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. You know, we're remembering remembering those things and those tragedies, but it's always about rejoicing. Even the millennial reign, even the time of the marriage supper of the Lamb is not to remember the 6,000 years of pain and trauma of the man's existence, of mankind's existence, but that we've been delivered and set free and we get to live with Him in that time. So we don't want to spend all the time mourning about the past. Although I would tell you in light, you know, because it's not so much the past now with what we're starting to see in Israel, because it is still so fresh. It's hard not to be angry and hurtful when you see what has happened to God's people. Okay, so I just wanted to do a thing before we talk about what we're going to talk about. The service today, so we're just going to stay up here today. Ben let me know that they were going to have this big thing earlier in the week and that they were going to try and be out of here by 2:30 so we could get down there and eat by 3. Well, there's about 5,000 cars down there, so I don't think they're going to be out of here by 3. So we just decided that we would just go ahead and eat up here. And if we are going to do the study will then come after cleanup, because there's still about 20 donuts rubbed into the carpet in here. So we just want to clean, get rid of the string, and just kind of get everything picked up. And then we'll see where we're at on time. And the reason I say that is because we've got the progressive Hanukkah thing going on. So tomorrow night we're going to be gathering up together. And I know that you can only stand each other so much, right? So we just, instead of hanging out here till 5 or 6 or 7, you know, we'll be over at the Breed's house tomorrow night at 5. And I've been informed that it was brisket and not latkes and donuts. Right. But you can bring latkes and donuts if you want, right? And game night. Okay. It is funny. I love, you know, this season. I mean, I kind of like all of them. But, you know, because there are certain foods, just like within our holidays, that, you know, after about December the 1st, you're like, if I see one more turkey, right? If I have one more plate of dressing and potatoes and gravy, I'm going to hurt somebody. And I'm kind of like that with latkes. Man, I look forward to them every year when they come out, but then I eat about 20 pounds worth of fried latkes. And yeah, I don't even have hair. It makes my hair greasy. Okay, so what I started, I guess it was last week, and what I told you was I felt like I needed to do was I wanted to give you guys the information about what's going on today, not prophetically, historically, because there is so much going on and there's so many people saying a lot of stupid things, and they're Christian leaders. When I was listening to one of the podcasts, they talked about how they were surprised, not so much that the known replacement theologist denominations and how they started coming out, and all of the universities and the universities that were founded from the replacement theology groups. But how many people from what we would call the charismatic circle that have come out against Israel? And so what I started to do last week was to go through the history of, and I, you know, I covered about, I think, 2,000 years in about 40 minutes, maybe 45 minutes, and I think I told you how this came about was I took the two courses from the college, Israel Today 1 and 2, something like 86 pages worth of notes, and when it's done, it is about 21 pages of notes now. And so I give you this, we're going to go through most of it today, and I'll wrap it up in 2 weeks when we come back. We'll be here next week. Ben will be leading worship, and Billy will be bringing the message. Casey and I will be out because it's her sister's surprise 40th birthday party. I can say that because she doesn't listen to our tape, so I don't have to worry about it. So, and we're driving down to Texas to go to that. So we will be out next weekend. But when we come back the following weekend, that's when I'm going to wrap all of this up, and then we'll have copies of all of this, and I'll have put on there the highlights. And I just think it's important that you have this information, and I'm going to hit a really big one shortly after we get going, that so you can give answers. You have to be able to give answers instead of people just saying things like, well, you know, Israel's in this occupied land, and they're occupiers, and they're committing genocide, and all this other foolishness. And I was having lunch with Dr. Mosley yesterday, and we were talking about how even Bill Maher was coming out and, you know, and saying all this stuff. And I said, you know, here's the irony, though. I said, this is the dilemma that Mr. Maher puts himself in. When he said that they are not occupiers, he said, no history. Our people have been there 12 to 1,500 years before Christ. We've been in the land for over 3,500 years. And then I go, that's true. But how'd you get there? Because whether you believe Israel just became a group of people that occupied Palestine, or if they became a group of people that occupied Canaan, either way, they're occupiers. That's a fact. They are occupiers of a land that they were not initially born into. A land that was given to them and promised to them by God through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the 12 sons. So they're occupying a land that they were not native to, but God. So to the reason I bring up Mr. Maher, who's an atheist, go, so now you have a dilemma, sir. You either have to acknowledge the one that said you could have this land, or you have to admit that your people are occupiers, because they are, but God. And when I come back in 2 weeks, I'm going to give you all of the biblical reasons, not only one, you know, we all know the promises, and we're going to briefly hit on that, but I'm going to give you all of the scriptures that made all of this happen historically. And what I hope you would see in the midst of hearing the history and all of this is too many times we want the Red Sea moment. That's what we want. We want God to move in a way that is completely undeniable, when oftentimes when dealing with Elijah, and Elijah ran out and was hidden and all this stuff, and he's crying out to God, and he finally shut up, and God said, it's not in the hurricane, the tornado, the earthquake, it's in the still small voice. Or in this case, the small gentle movement of the hand of God moving upon his people, moving upon individuals, and that means world leaders, presidents, prime ministers, scientists, and all of this to bring to bear where we're at today. And it's this, the restoration of Israel is really the primary reason why I believe what I believe about prophecy, but also the timing of why it is. All right? Okay, so I have 110 bullet points. We're not doing it all today, so don't trip. And we're on page 6 of 21. So I'll do my best to try and keep you awake, because this isn't a lecture format. Right? I took all of the notes and made it all a nice bullet so you can read it when you have it, but then I'm going to ad-lib on some things in certain points, okay? So we wrapped up last week. We went through the history of what happened to the Jewish people, but one of the things that I had to leave out that I could not go into was what happened every time a different group of people were over Israel, they were over the land. Told you how it was named by Hadrian into Palestine in 135. And that's where the name came from, because he did that as a thorn, you know, a spit in the eye of the Jewish people, their greatest adversaries, the Philistines. Now, what was funny is a few weeks ago when the Turkish leader, Erdogan, was given a speech about how we need to do something about the land of Palestine, he had a big slide up. And he was talking about the land of, in the transliteration, literally said F-I-L-I-S-T-I-N-E, Philistine. He's talking about the land of Palestine, but in their transliteration of it, it literally said Philistine. I was like, you're so stupid. It's just so funny how ignorant people can be because of their blind hatred or whatever the reason is that they've chosen not to see something. Anyway, and so there's just so much that happened, and how the Jewish people, and what I said was that these are the only people in the history of mankind that ever lost their homeland, but yet they kept their language, they kept their culture, they kept everything, and then were brought back. Everybody else ceased to exist. The Mayans, the Amalekites, the Sumerians, right? Oh, not the Samaritans, but the Sumerians, all of these ancient peoples don't exist. So why do these one people exist? Why does this one insignificant group still exist? And also, their existence is a spit in the eye of the Arabs, and it is also a spit in the eye of replacement theology. Because replacement theologists said all of that stuff's spiritual now. We don't have to worry about literal land. We don't have to worry about literal Israel. It's all spiritual now. And then all of a sudden they showed up and they had to go, we're going to have to rewrite our books. Or they're saying what they're saying today is they have no right. God's done with them and they need to stop this. And that's what's happening today. Okay. And so we kind of went through that history and we talked about some of the different things that were happening. And the last thing we kind of wrapped up with was a thing called the Dreyfus Affair, which changed a man named Theodor Herzl. A lot of people know his name as kind of being the founder of modern Zionism. But he was initially an atheist. Actually, I think he died an atheist. But his mentality was like, hey, it was a time. Now we just need to be Jews wherever we find ourselves. So we don't need to go back. Until these false accusations came against this Dreyfus guy, and then all of the stuff that was happening, and he finally just got this revelation, says, if we don't have a homeland, this is never going to stop. And so that's what kind of stirred him to kind of get the ball rolling and all of that. And then there was other leaders, but the biggest one, and I got a couple of them in here, but I'm not going to go through them. I'll let you read them when we give the whole thing to you so you can see some of these names. But let's see. The president of the State of Israel, the first one, Chaim Weizmann. He was initially Russian and then moved to Germany so he could go to college because he couldn't go to college in Russia. But then found himself, I believe, in England. And he was a scientist. He created this ingredient that was used in making explosives. And those explosives and those particular weapons turned the tide of World War I. And so at the end of it, the prime minister asked him, he said, what can we do for you for your contribution to us winning the war over the Ottomans? And he said, give my people their land back. So a guy who went to school to become a scientist, who was just working science stuff, found himself standing before the prime minister of England and then found himself setting the ball rolling for getting the people. You may not think that you are making much of an impact, because many times we want Billy Graham revivals, and that's not how it works. Most of the time, it's the people that you just come in contact with work, just being a simple employee with wherever you're at, someone that they can look at, who's reliable, who's consistent, who's not a gossip, who's trustworthy, that is going to make an impact. So we need to get over the idea that we need to have these big stadium size events. And so he got the ball rolling. Okay, Gold of My Ear. I got some stuff in here. If you have not seen the movie that just simply called Golda, came out about 2-3 months ago. It's on Hulu or Netflix or something right now. It's very good. The woman, what was her name? Helen Mirren. She's the one that played Golda, and I thought they did a really good job. They did a great job with the story. And it was so weird that is apropos the right thing, that the timing of it, because it was right at the 50th anniversary, and then how this whole surprise thing happened with the Yom Kippur War, and then now we have this surprise thing 50 years later. And it just shows you this is never, ever, 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 ever going to end until Messiah comes back. It's just not. You can't talk to, you can't coerce, you can't give enough money, you can't say pretty please, you cannot do anything with people that hate you to their core. Okay, so besides Weizmann and Herzl and Golda and some of these other guys, Pinsker, we're going to talk about the Arab side. Because there was a leader of the Arab independence struggle to get free from the Ottoman Empire. His name was Sharif Hussein. He was appointed to the most powerful Islamic position of the Grand Sharif of Mecca. The British encouraged him to motivate the Arabs to rise against the enemies of the Turks during the World War. As a result, he led the Arab revolt against the Turks in 1916, and although Sharif Hussein took the title of the King of the Arab Countries, the Allied powers only recognized him as the King of Western Saudi. And it's during this time period that the Lawrence of Arabia and all of that stuff is based off him working with this individual, all right? And he, and just as Wiseman was wanting the Jews to, or the Brits to influence to be able to get Palestine turned into Israel, he wanted them to do the same thing and create the Arabs, right? To create the Arab nation in that same region, because the British had control of that whole region. You know, the Ottoman Empire was all part of what is Turkey today, west, a little bit north, and then down into that region. So they had all of that. And then when they lost World War I, that's when all of this stuff started to split. And it's no different, to give you an example, if you go and read when Daniel was seeking the Lord, this is the same thing without the prophetic words, without some prophet saying this is what was going to happen. It is the same thing how God used Persia, the Medes and the Persians, and the Greeks and the Romans to bring about his plan. And so we would look at that and go, oh, that's the book of Daniel. Of course that makes sense. Well, this is still part of the book of prophecy where God's using nations to bring about the return of his people. He used Cyrus, the leader of Persia, to get the ball rolling to get his people to go back after the Babylonian stuff. So I'm just trying to make the point that even though we don't have these books that continued on, it's still the hand of God moving to fulfill all of those prophecies that we'll talk about in a couple weeks. All right. So Hussein was bitterly disappointed when the British failed to keep their promise to him of an Arab independence in return for their support against the Turks. Hussein agreed to Jewish immigrants to Palestine as long as it was a home for the persecuted Jews. But he said in no way would he support a state for the people of Israel. He was somewhat being humanitarian, going, look, the ones that are being ran out from around the world, we'll make a place for them, but they're coming to Palestine, and we will not accept you turning this into a Jewish state. All right, so things took a drastic turn in the Middle East with World War I and the Ottoman Empire. Okay, don't need to read that. By 1915, the first plans were drawn up to divide the Turkish Empire. In May of 1916, Britain and France accepted the Sykes Agreement as a plan for the future of Palestine. This plan was to set up two Arab states in place of the Turkish Empire from Damascus to Aqaba. But unknown to the Arabs, as part of this plan, the British determined to establish the French international control of Palestine on the west bank of the Jordan. So they basically split it down the middle, and they were going to give the west bank, the west side of the Jordan area, the Jordan River, because this wasn't Jordan as you know Jordan today. It was just based off the Jordan River, and then the other part for the Arab side. And some of the British people, leaders, it said, began to feel responsibility towards the increasing Jewish immigrants that were going to Palestine as they noticed the rising anti-Semitism in Europe and in England. And a major change was happening in the British leadership. And so they saw all of this that happened with Dreyfus, that happened in Germany. Russia and France and all these other places where all of the anti-Semitism was rising up. And they're like, look, They're going to keep persecuting, and we got to do something. So they said, you know, after Wiseman and Herschel and all that, that's when they started allowing more and more to go. That's why you're going to see this increase in our day. Because just as that anti-Semitism stirred up and got the nation built, it's going to continue because it's going to force the Jewish people back home. Remember the prophecy in the book of Jeremiah where he says, first I will send the fishermen, and then I will send the hunters. So what God is really doing initially going, hey, guys, come home. Hey, guys, come home. And then he's going to go, I told you to go home, right? And so initially he's going to draw them in like fishermen, and then he's going to send the hunters to go in after them. And that's what this is happening, because it's starting to drive the people into realize. And I know, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this, that the guy, Jeremy Gimpel, he went around the States, and we've had him here twice. And he believed his whole call when he comes to the States is to warn the Jews to get out of America. He said, because when America falls, they're going to blame you. All right. On November the 2nd, 1917, Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, made public the contents of a letter that he wrote on behalf of the cabinet to Lord Rothschild, who represented the Jewish people, favor having a Jewish homeland in Palestine. This was called the Balfour Declaration. It was simply a statement of British policy, and this was not international law at the time, but it became a document that they used to say, this is what we're going to use. Okay, following the war, an association of self-governing nations in 1919 formed a peace treaty in order to promote international cooperation and to achieve peace. This association was known as the League of Nations. This association gave authority to certain countries to administer the affairs of the region. At the San Remo Conference, it was in San Francisco, I believe, in April of 1920, a mandate was conferred on Britain to administer the affairs of Palestine and Mesopotamia, and Britain began to put into action the Balfour Declaration that was made in 1917. The mandate by the League of Nations raised that Balfour Declaration to the status of a treaty. And so initially it went for, hey, we need to do this, and then when the League of Nations came together, then they basically is what made it law. And then, well, I'm kind of getting ahead of it a little bit, but when I did the prophecy stuff, I mentioned how World War I created the League of Nations, World War II created the United Nations, and then World War III will, in my opinion, create the final United Nation beast system and all of that. It will be on the heels of another global conflict. How are we going to handle this, right? So that's what I think will come out of that. So Balfour had met Herzl and heard his idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And when he was foreign minister, he had interviewed Chaim Weizmann after the Jews had been offered East Africa as a homeland instead of Palestine. In this conversation, Weizmann said, Mr. Balfour, supposing I were to offer you Paris instead of London. He said, would you take it? He sat up and looked at me and said, but Dr. Weizmann, we already have London. He said, this is true. He said, but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh. Balfour believed, along with Prime Minister Lord George Allenby, Churchill, and other British leaders, that the statements concerning the Jews and their homeland in Palestine were a major factor in any decisions regarding the Middle East. Balfour believed that the Jews were exiles who should be given their homeland in payment of the Christians' immeasurable debt. Balfour wrote, the position of the Jews is unique. For them, race, religion, and country are interrelated, and as they are interrelated in the case, no other religion, and as in no other religion or no other country on earth. They are completely intertwined together. You cannot separate them. You can say to the Palestinians, and this is one of the things that in the back channels that they said was that internet stories, was that part, not of Israel, but Egypt, in that part of the Sinai, that they were going to carve that out for Palestine. And they could do that. Why? Because there's no such thing as a Palestinian people. Half of them are Egyptians and Arabs and Jordanians and all the other different nationalities are really tribes. Not nationality, tribes is the best way to say that. Okay, so the persecution, it's a hard word, continued in Europe, and then a lot of the Jewish immigrants started to flood to Palestine. And there was Herzl and some of these other guys created companies to start businesses, to buy lands, and do other stuff in that region. So yes, they were working, as we were jokingly talk about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and how it's part of the Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. No, it's common sense. You know, if you're going to build a church, you don't go, oh Lord, would you drop it from the heavens? No, you hire a contractor and they pour concrete and they get electricity and you got to work within the system. That's what they were doing. Moved by the Spirit of God, whether they do it or not. You can read that later. All right, by the time of World War I, there were already 54 Jewish towns and settlements had been developed in that region. And there were about 500,000 Arabs in that time and 90,000 Jews lived in that same area. Remember last week I gave you some of the numbers and I showed you how there has always been a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. They did not all go away. There has always been a presence, even if it was just a few thousand. And at one time when the population was only like 200,000 total in all of quote-unquote Palestine, there were still like 5,000 to 10,000 Jews amongst that. So there's always been a remnant of Jewish people. Let's see. Okay. Okay, Britain was given the mandate to rule over Palestine and told them to use their best endeavors to facilitate Jewish immigration, reconstituting the Jewish national home. The mandate recognized English, Arabic, and Hebrew as the three official languages of that region. And the British were given full authority of legislation and administration. Each year were required to submit a report to the League of Nations. Then we get into 1921, the colonial secretary, Winston Churchill, visited Palestine to investigate the problems. And in July of 1922, Churchill published the White Paper, which was his answer to the problem. Although Churchill reaffirmed his support of the Jewish national homeland, his solution seemed more of a hindrance to the desires of the Jews. The White Paper solutions included the dividing of the Palestine down the Jordan River, creating Transjordan, which Britain would continue to administer through the government of Abdullah under the British mandate. Also, the papers restricted the Jewish homeland to the area west of Jordan. To avoid a Jewish state by limiting the Jewish immigration to what the country could afford, meaning that the land and all of that could support, the British called these the White Papers because many were prepared hastily and submitted to the House of Commons without the traditional blue cover used for important documents. The Churchill White Papers were the official policy of the British mandate over Palestine, and the Zionist executive reluctantly signed it, but the Arab delegation rejected it, as they have every single time. All right, so this is the part that you really need to pay attention to. In 1925, that guy Sharif Hussein, the guy that worked with Lawrence of Arabia, the guy who wanted that Arab homeland, he was kicked out of that region and he was exiled to Cyprus. And a man named Ibn Saud was given Mecca. By who? The British. Sharif Hussein remained in Cyprus until his death in 1931. Later, the British appointed Sharif Hussein, his son Abdullah, as the king of Transjordan, and another one of his sons, Fazail, the king of Iraq. So when you hear that the British carved out a part of land and gave it to the Jewish people and they had no right to do so, you have to go, okay, who won the war? We now have the land. We whooped you. We get to do what we want with it. Whether you agree with that or not, that's what we did here. And by the way, that's what every piece of land has been done with around the world. There has never been a piece, there is not ever in history that a land was not developed by conquest. It's human nature. It's what we do. We fight. I'm not saying it's right. It's just what has happened. Because of the nature, the fallen nature, that's what we do. We're like, hey, I want that. Hey, let me get 20,000 of my buddies and we're going to go take it. Right? And then the guy who led it, we're like, hey, he's king. He's president. That's what happens. Okay, that's what we did here. We come over here and we're like, hey, Brits, we don't like you no more, even though most of us came from you. And sorry, Indians. That's what we did. Deny it or not. So that's what people do. And so for people to go, well, they had no right to do it. Yeah, they did have a right to do it because, they were appointed by the League of Nations. Here's the other part. Israel is the only country that not only has the deed to the land in here, they were given the land by the United Nations. They said, here's the deed to this land. Arabs rejected it. So now back to Mr. Hussein. One son, Abdullah, or not Abdullah, his one son, it was King Abdullah. He is the grandfather of the current King of Jordan. So they carved out this area and called it Transjordan and gave it to Hussein, one of Husseini's sons. The other area, east of that, in Iraq, was Fazl. Guess who he's the father of? Saddam Hussein. That's where the Husseins came from. And then Ibn Saud, Saudi Arabia. So when people say to you they have no right, then you tell the Arabs to get out You tell Hussein to get out. You tell the descendants of Fazl to get out, because the Brits did the same thing to them. So now we're done talking. And that's really, I mean, that's like the biggest part of all of this, is to pretend like that part of history didn't happen, or these other, they were prominent families. Well, you can't deny that they weren't prominent families, because they're like, well, who am I going to give it to? The guy over here who's got, you know, five kids and no money, or am I going to give it to the guy who's been ruling kind of this area and all of his 12 sons or however many sons they had, and he's got all the money and he's got the military power, so we're going to let him control that region. It's the same thing they dealt with in Afghanistan. It's the same thing they dealt with in Iraq, because that part of the, and it's the same thing, what they won't admit, they're still dealing with it in Palestine today. They are so tribal. They are so, you know, we would equate it by our last names. We'll just use our last names. It's like, look, if you're not of the family of Hess, I'm shanking you, right? I don't trust you. You're a Schubert, don't like you. My great-great-grandfather had a problem with your great-great-grandfather, so we ain't talking. And if I see you down the street, I'm going to kill your son. That's what's happened. And then so there's a great movie called the 12 Strong, about what happened in Afghanistan within weeks after 9/11. If you've not seen it, you have to see it. And it's about this 12-man Green Beret team, and they were getting the one leader, and they were trying to get them through this pass to get to the town, and he refused to go because he found out that another special ops team was getting another leader over there. And so the leader of that Green Beret team chewed him out because he says, you were really only about yourself and these stupid tribes, when what we're trying to do is for the greater part of Afghanistan. And so then he just walked out of the thing. Eventually guilt got over him and he came back. And then, you know, but it's, I'm just saying, it's all like that, you know. It's like today, the Army-Navy game, right? It's like we just can't get along. we just can't get along. All right. Okay. Let me go through some of this other stuff. I would take weeks if I had to kind of give all of this. Okay. In July of 1937, there was a thing called the Peel Commission. They limited the immigration to the Jewish people to 12,000 people a year. All right, that was in 1937. Seems like there might have been something significant happening in Europe in the mid-1930s. And I believe this is part of the stuff that led to what ultimately happened to Britain, was they began to turn their back on the people of Israel. This will be the final stage for America. I mean, God's got more than enough moral reasons to smack us around. But right now, we're still supporting His people. The minute that we don't, we'll be done. And I think that's ultimately the stuff that happened, because this limiting of the immigration to the land of Israel, to the land of Palestine at that time, forced hundreds of thousands of Jews to have to stay in Europe. And it just, in all honesty, I can't remember if it was in last week, where when that happened, Adolf Hitler looked at that as the world's permission, condonement of what he was starting to do. All right, so there were no common grounds between the Jews and the Arabs, and Palestine was to be divided into two self-governing communities. Palestine and Transjordan was divided into three regions of a Jewish state: a larger Arab state, and a permanently mandated British region that included Jerusalem. So in 1921, the High Commissioner Samuel appointed Haj Amin al-Husseini. I wonder if these guys just go by like, hey, Haj. Or, I mean, do they sit there like when a guy walks in and talk for 20 minutes and go, who is that again? Please don't ask him his name. We're never going to get to the end of this. All right, he was appointed the Supreme Muslim Council, giving him unlimited power to control that side of the Islamic side of things in Palestine. And he was absolutely against all of the Jewish immigration and settlement, and went about to create activities that produced terror among both the Jews and the Arabs. Terrorism. And in 1939, his victims exceeded 3,000, and he associated himself both with Mussolini and Hitler. His ideas were clearly conveyed in a letter to Hitler in 1939 when he said, "The Arab people confidently expect the result of your final victory. It will be their independence and complete liberation, and they will then be linked to your country by a treaty of friendship and collaboration." And so now you have, in that region, the Arab leaders going, "Go Hitler." All the while, the British were like going, "You guys can't go no more. We got too many going down there." Okay, and this was while the Nazis were implementing the Nuremberg Laws in Germany during the 1930s. The situation in Palestine had deteriorated because of the white paper issue. The Jews were now trapped because they could not come to Palestine, and most of the other nations of the world were refusing a home to the desperate Jews who were being persecuted by Hitler. And Hitler had interpreted this as the part I was referring to, is their refusal by the other nations to support and approve of what he started to do. But the final solution, yes, that was the name of the thing of what Hitler did, but it actually began in the Soviet Union. And it says, the task force of the SS tracked down Jews, transported them outside of the cities, and shot them. And by this, 1.4 million Jews were killed in the Soviet Union. This was all during that period of time. And I really do think that just as this laid the groundwork and began to happen prior to World War II, you're going to start seeing this happen and increase globally. Just prepare yourself for that. One thing that's interesting to me, anybody understand what, when you say Islam, and they'll tell you that jihad is not about the conflict, but they say it's more about the internal conflict of an Arab with his relationship to God and his sin and that kind of stuff. Isn't it interesting that Adolf Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, Mein Kampf means my personal struggle, and his personal struggle about that, his entire thing was about his hatred for the Jews. Same spirit, same demon. He had the same internal strife and struggle with how much he hated the Jews, and so does Islam. They are of their father, the devil. And on November the 10th, 1938, a tremendous rioting against the Jews went throughout Germany, and a new report of a wave of destruction, vandalism, arson, unequaled in Germany since the 30-year war. This night is remembered as Kristallnacht, or the Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. That night, 191 synagogues were burned, and another 76 were totally destroyed. Thousands of Jewish shops were broken into and looted so much that the witnesses called it a wild frenzy of broken glass. And when you hear the reports of what happened in southern Israel today and the wild frenzy in which they went about doing what they did, that's why even secular people are using words like this is evil and demonic. Because when you read the reports, and if you could ever stomach hearing any of it, it is absolutely demonic. They burned all the books, the Jewish books, the Torahs, anything that was Judaic in nature. I'll be interested to see what happens to the people in the Hebrew Roots community when they're really proud and bold online about hating everything that's not completely Jewish, and then it comes down to, really? You believe that? Are you Jewish? And then their life is going to be threatened by it? In 1942, in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, there were 500,000 Jews that lived in that area. And prior to the war, it only housed 35,000 people. That's when you read and hear about those stories, which Schindler's List, the movie, did a pretty good job showing what that life was like. And then when the Nazis went through there and did what they did. Let's see. Okay, and a guy named Richard Ringner, secretary of the World Jewish Congress in Geneva, sent a famous telegram note to the Ringner Telegram, and in this telegram he informed both the World Jewish Congress in America and Great Britain of the plan of total extermination of the Jews in Europe that was conceived in Hitler's headquarters, and the State Department did not deliver the message because of the manifestly unsubstantiated character of the telegram. And in 1938, representatives of 32 nations met in Avignon, on the shores of Geneva in Switzerland, at the invitation of President Roosevelt. Attending this meeting were officials of refugee organizations who had photographs, eyewitness accounts of what was happening to the Jews. And one by one, the national representatives gave reasons why they could not take the desperate Jewish refugees. Golda Meir was present in the audience as the Jewish observer from Palestine and gives this report. Sitting there in that magnificent hall, I was listening to the delegates of 32 countries rise in each in turn to explain how much the world would have liked to take in substantial numbers of refugees, and unfortunate it was that they were not able to do so was a terrible experience. I wanted to get up and scream, "Don't you know that these numbers are human beings?" This famous meeting is known as the Avignon Refugee Conference, where many nations rejected God's people. You can look at this one of two ways. Either God shut their mouths because he was trying to get them home. You could argue that maybe they would have taken in some of the refugees and they would have eventually made it home, but they weren't going home of their own accord. Just like many of the Jews stayed in Babylon. You know, you've heard of the Jerusalem Talmud. There's the Babylonian Talmud. There were big Jewish learning centers in Iraq up until around 1000 AD. There were tens of thousands of Jewish people that lived in Iraq. They didn't go home. Why? Because they were doing fine. They had their falafel stands and whatever, you know, and say they were making a living. They weren't being killed over there. Okay, the United Nations came out of it. Like we said, it was informed in April of 1945, just 1 month before the surrender of Germany. The conditions of acceptance to the United Nations was the nation's participation in the war against Germany. And despite these regulations, delegates from our four Arab countries arrived in San Francisco to be part of the United Nations, who not only did not fight against Germany, but were supportive of Hitler. Britain pressured Egypt, Yemen, Saudi Arabia to make a declaration against Germany so that they could gain entrance. Talked him into it. And then the Jewish refugees who have arrived on the shores of Palestine were turned back by the British blockade. The Jews often had special permits to allow Jewish refugees to enter, but even then they were rejected, and some Jewish refugees were still brought in illegally. And when photographs and word of this rejection reached the newspapers in Europe and America, the world opinion and the British taxpayers became an effective weapon to help the Jews. And in May of 1942, an emergency Zionist conference that was held at the Biltmore Hotel in New York with 600 delegates, mostly American and European leaders, this meeting concluded that the Jews should settle for nothing short of Jewish commonwealth in Palestine that would become a part of the democratic world, that were even willing to accept the territorial limitations in Palestine, meaning that, you know, the land they said couldn't support it, but above all, that they would only settle for Jewish self-rule. And I'll pause here in just a minute. A major break for the Jews happened during the UN UNSCOP representatives to Palestine. At the same during the time of their visiting, there was this exodus in 1947 of a refugee ship that had arrived, witnessed by some of these UNSCOP representatives. The vessel was a battered American ferry packed with 4,500 displaced Jews. When the Exodus 1947 tried to land in Palestine, the British Navy fired upon it, and when the struggles were finished, there were 3 Jews killed and 100 wounded. The crew of the Exodus surrendered only after the British began ramming the vessel, and in spite of the suffocating heat and threat of disease, the Jewish passengers refused to leave, stating that they would only go to Palestine. After 3 weeks, the French and British made the ship depart, and the British sent the Jews back to Germany. About 1,500 refused to disembark, and they were carried off by the British using clubs and hoses. The episode lasted 3 months and was extensively reported on in the newspapers throughout the world. And because of this moving experience, the UNSCOP sent a delegation to visit the refugee centers in Germany and Austria, where they saw some 250,000 Jews who were waiting for their departure to Palestine. So just as these other guys were used, this situation was used to get the world to begin to see not only what was just done to the Jewish people, but how even after all of that, the world was still preventing them from being able to get to Palestine. And it was on May the 1948, the British lowered the Union Jack, the British flag, in Jerusalem. And by that afternoon, there was a full-scale war and fighting throughout the country. And it was at that, Ben-Gurion, the leader at that moment, he still offered a hand to the Jewish people or to the Arab people, and they still rejected it. And what I'll finish up with when we come back together, because I'm going to wrap up with a little bit of a message here with this. is they still refused it, and then they told all of the quote-unquote Palestinians to come out because we are going to go in and destroy all of the Jews. And so that's when all of the surrounding nations, and that's when people think this was really the Psalm 83 war, because all of the surrounding nations then went in to Israel. And when they lost, they're like, and then all of a sudden you got all these Palestinians going, hey, you told us if we came out here, you'd go in and we could go back home. Like, what are we going to do now? They're like, oh, well, we got some nice tents over here. Don't worry about the fence. Don't worry about the fence. They did that in that area, outside of Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. One of the things that nobody will ever answer the question about is everybody's having a fit about what's happening in Gaza, and yes, we want to be merciful to what's happening. But when they say, and they killed somebody, I read the interview and watched the video of one of the guys declared after they killed a woman, they said, we're going to take it back to Gaza so the people can play with it. I'm talking evil here, okay? Again, you cannot communicate with these people. We'll just leave that part there. But nobody said anything about what's happening to the Palestinians in Jordan. Nobody said a word when they killed tens of thousands of them in Syria during the Syrian civil war, where 1 million Syrians died. But yet, a couple thousand die in Gaza and everybody's losing their mind. This is spiritual, and I hope you understand that. I just wanted to give you the history of some of this, and then I'll wrap up with, very, you know, when we come back together, when I come back in 2 weeks, and just give you a synopsis of some of the other things that happened that showed, and we'll briefly talk about the Six-Day War, and we'll talk about the Yom Kippur War, and how it was after this that all of the terrorism and all of that stuff really started to ratchet it up. All right, so what do we take out of this? I didn't just want to make it just a boring message on history. Right, this is God's history. This is His story about Him using His people. And I want to share something. Using the season that we're in now with Hanukkah. So the moral message from this history lesson on Israel is God is faithful to His word. Period. He is faithful to His people. He said that He would send them around the world, but then even in their disobedience, that He would bring them back. And He has brought His people back, not because of their righteousness, but because of His namesake. And if God has given you a word, then stand on that word, and He will show Himself faithful. If He's given you a word that He spoke to your spirit, if He's given you a word in His word, then you stand on that word. And this is why we cannot be so dismissive and have and accept an idea of replacement theology, because that means God is not faithful. And there is a difference about the spiritual Israel and the literal Israel. But just because there are, because you know, some of the replacement theologians will use things like, you know, what is a Jew? And it's one who's spiritually, not literally, and they somehow think those things now replace the literal. It's like, no, He still has a promise to the literal people. And this is what God is showing to the world, that He is faithful to His word and to His covenant, and He will be for you. If He's not faithful to His people, then He could even turn His back on what His Son did. If He can turn His back on the Sinai covenant, on the Mosaic covenant, on the Adamic covenant, then He can turn His back on the Yeshua covenant. So some would want the message of Hanukkah to be to insert America here. So when we think about Hanukkah, we're like, yes, it's the people of God that were overcoming what was happening in that region, and that's going to be us, and we're going to be victorious in this nation, and we can apply all kinds of spiritual and metaphorical things to this. So, is that true? Yes, but spiritually. That's where I'm going to turn it on you. I don't believe we'll be victorious here in this nation in the physical. Because the ultimate story of this season at Hanukkah is that the light of the world gave us victory over the things of the Spirit. And if God has brought all of these other things and all of these other nations, then America, in all of its arrogance, can go, we're America. And you know what? The sun never set on the British Empire. And guess what? It does now. And so America, if we ever stop supporting His people, if we ever stop supporting God's plan, but also let me say it this way, and this applies to us. This applies to me. This is why I always say things when I examine myself. America simply could have been a tool created by God to send the gospel around the world that would ultimately get to the place where the President of the United States in 1948 was the final vote casting for the United Nations that caused the establishment of the nation of Israel. And as soon as we're done with that, God goes, now I'm done with your purpose, America. God raises kings and nations and causes them to fall. And that could have been all that we existed for that period of time. And so what we're seeing now is, yes, the choice factor of people leaving and running away from God, but also God setting the stage for the grand finale, for the crescendo of the story of all stories. And why I said this initially about from like a pastor perspective, remember how Billy and I talk about how the scariest verses in all the Bible is, depart from me, I never knew you, and all these people are going to say, I did all these wonderful things in your name. God simply goes, you were a tool that I used to get my, had anything to do with your righteousness or your holiness. I wanted you to walk righteous and holy, but I still used the gift that I gave you. Now I'm done with you because you wouldn't walk right before me. You have to be careful. So if we are any of the characters in the story of Hanukkah, then I would say that we would be the Hellenized Jews because the church has compromised like the Hellenistic Jews. And in this season of lights, we need to ask ourselves, have we compromised in any areas? In Matthew 5, Yeshua said, neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light to all of those who are in the house. Let your light shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. The other reasons that I don't think we can insert America into the story or into the characters of the story is because there's too much friendly fire in the church today. We don't fight against the Greeks and we don't fight against the Hellenists. We got too many Maccabeans shooting too many Maccabeans. We have misidentified the targets. We have Maccabeans attacking Maccabeans when they think they're actually attacking the Greeks and the Hellenists, people who refuse to be united for the cause but think they are more powerful as individuals. We have too many critics, too many of those trying to organize, and the fighters are telling them where they are wrong instead of offering solutions and finding out how they can help in any perceived blind spots. The battle and the reason that the Maccabees were so successful is because they were united against those who had compromised. And what we find is too many times in the church today, we are arguing and dividing over things and we don't realize it's Maccabee against Maccabee, it's friendly fire. And we actually think we're fighting against Greeks and we actually think we're fighting against Hellenists. And that's part of the other reason why I don't think that we will be successful. And one of the ways that we can spiritually apply this story and then this season to us today. We have to become unified, not perfect in doctrine. That's a misunderstanding where my dad's family denomination, all of that, they believe there will come a time where everything will be seen perfectly. And I was like, I don't know which New Testament you're reading. Because they said, Paul wrote some really weird things, right? So even Peter really didn't fully get all the stuff that Paul was writing on some things. So in doctrine, that part, but unified in the cause of Messiah and who He is and what He did for us, that's the thing that we need to be unified on. And we can't, because even within the Hebrew roots community, we fight against one another. We fight against the non-Sabbath keeping people. And even the Pentecostals fight against the Baptists. And so it's just, that's friendly fire. That's Maccabee against Maccabee, and that's the stuff that needs to come to an end. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we bless You, we praise You, and we thank You for this day. We thank You for this season and all that it represents. and how you had a group of people, a remnant group of people that said, we will not compromise, we will not give in, and we will follow your word, and we will live according to your word. Help us to examine ourselves and to make sure that we are part of that remnant and that we have not created blind spots, that we have not created mixture, that we have not become Hellenized and think that we're still fully walking in your word. Help us to take an honest assessment of our own hearts so that we can make sure that we are ready for battle, ready to give an account, ready to be a witness, Lord. We lift up your people, Lord God, and we just do praise that you give wisdom to the military, to the political leaders, that this battle that they are fighting now, that they will be victorious. But we know this is a representation of the spiritual, and we know that ultimate victory will only come when they will look upon him whom they have pierced. So we pray that you begin to remove the scales from their eyes, the scales from the religious leaders, from the rabbis, that they can begin to explain Psalms 22, Isaiah 53, and all of the other prophetic words, Daniel 9, that spoke about the coming of Messiah, that they would see and look upon him whom they've pierced and begin to just preach to the world that he was Messiah, that he is Messiah. And so we pray that that victory would come, and then we know that that literal, physical, earthly battle would be successful. We just thank you for all that you're doing, Lord God, in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right.